Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 4th, 2015, and please let the record note that we do have a quorum. Members, we have three items on our agenda today. We're going to start off. We're glad to have the Minnesota milk producers here for their day on the Hill. So we've agreed to allow them to come in and talk about the good work that you folks do. Today we have Maren Bozic and Pat Luneman. So, gentlemen, whenever you're ready, welcome to the committee, and we look forward to hearing your presentation here this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is my mic working?
You just have to push the head towards you a little bit.
Okay, that started well. Do you hear me well?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Maren Bozic. I'm assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. I also serve as associate director of Midwest Dairy Foods Research Center. I've been asked by Minnesota milk producers to come today and give a short presentation on the state of Minnesota dairy sector. I'm a numbers guy. I will only talk about trends, and then my colleague, Mr. Luneman, will talk about policy initiatives, I understand. Also, to answer the questions, you may be having this mind, my accent is not from Minnesota. I'm originally from Croatia. I'm just one of many immigrants in the Minnesota ag sector. been at the university for 3 years now. We have allocated 8 to 10 minutes for my part of the presentation, and then Pat is going to go for another five or so. So without further ado, numbers can get dry, but I still want to outline a few of them for you. There's this handout that we distributed around. A few vital statistics for Minnesota dairy sector. We have just short of 500,000 dairy cows. We have 3,500 dairy farms in the state. And cash revenue on Minnesota dairy farms in 2014 was just over $2 billion. 2014 was a pretty good year for Minnesota dairymen. In 2013, Minnesota had 56 dairy plants. On the next page, we have 18 artisan dairies, 7 butter and powder plants, 8 cheese plants, 9 fluid, soft, and ice cream plants, 12 processed dairy foods, and 1 research facility here at St. Paul on the University of Minnesota campus. My boss, Dean Brian Burr, published a report 4 years ago on the Animal Agriculture Benchmark Report, it's called, in 2011, and he found that the dairy sector contributes $3.2 billion in total direct economic activity to Minnesota economy, that we are substantial users of corn and soybeans, that each additional cow adds over $7,000 in economic activity through direct and indirect effects, and that the processing activity adds $1.8 billion to the farm value of milk. Overall, the dairy sector contributes 15,000 direct jobs in farming, processing, and feed manufacturing. I'd like to tell a story today about structural change in Minnesota dairy economy. On slide 5, I have trends in animal agriculture in Minnesota starting from 1990. So to normalize this, I've put 1990 to be 100%, and then let's see what happened since in hogs and chicken and beef, turkey, and dairy. What you see is that the swine industry prospered really well. They have nearly doubled the number of hogs in the state of Minnesota relative to 25 years ago. Chickens, beef, and turkey are either growing or holding their own. And the only major animal agriculture sector in Minnesota that has struggled since has been dairy sector. We now have just over 60% of cows that we had 25 years ago. So what I read from this slide is that Minnesota is friendly to animal agriculture, but the dairy has some particular challenges that Mr. Luneman will later address and in his part of the presentation. On slide 6, you see the milk production in Minnesota from 1990 onwards. We have a long declining trend between 1990 and 2004. We have recovered somewhat since, but over the last 5 years, the production has been stagnant. On slide 7, on the next page, this slide really tells a story on the technological change in U.S. dairy sector and the type of farms that are growing in importance. As you can see on this slide, in the blue line, the farms with 100 to 200 cows peaked in their importance in 1997, and their share of milk produced in the United States has declined since. That is also the case for many other farm sizes larger than 200 cows. 200 to 500 cows dairies, they have started declining since 2000. Even farms 500 to 1,000 cows, they have started declining after 2007. What this is indicating is that there are substantial economies of scale in dairy production, and that for Minnesota sector to be viable, we have to have a solid mix of traditional farms as well as new entrepreneurs who want to grow in Minnesota. On slide 8, I have put together family income on Minnesota dairies from 2006 through 2013. So think of this as an average. It covers long enough period. We see that farms of all sizes are doing fairly well relative to U.S. median income. However, this picture includes not just income from dairying, but also from crops. It includes off-farm income, and it excludes money that would have to be set aside to reinvest in farm assets. So what I read from slide 8 is there's no immediate threat from hunger or poverty in Minnesota ag sector. However, that picture is incomplete and needs to be complemented by looking particularly what happens to income from dairying rather than crops or off-farm income. On slide 9, you see that we are losing between 4 and 6% of Minnesota dairy farms every year. This is just a typical structural change, one we cannot really fight or overcome, and what we have to accept. These people are not going out of business in a sense that they're getting bankrupt. These are mostly retirements. Farms at the end of their life cycle with a new generation deciding. Last time, I promise. Their next generation looking for urban jobs or in allied industries. But for the most part, we don't have farms in Minnesota going under. This is not what slide 9 indicates. Slide 10 shows that decline in Minnesota dairy farms comes primarily from categories 1 to 50 cows and 50 to 100 cow dairies. Those categories have shrank tremendously between 2003 and 2013, so over this 10-year period I have shown here. How do we reconcile the previous slide that shows that everybody is doing well and we're able to support their families? How do we reconcile that with this structural change and exits? Well, the slide that reconciles that is slide 11, where I have excluded all off-farm income, and I have asked, the question this slide is asking is, okay, well, if we didn't have any crops, if we had to buy crops at market prices, what would be the dairy income on these farms? And what you see is that you need 150 to 300 cows in order to have a family income just from dairying that would be at least as big as U.S. median income. What I read from slide 11 is that the state of Minnesota and our producers and supporting industries like and university have to work together to enable those dairies, those family dairies that want to bring in next generation to grow and prosper so they can have income from dairying be as large as U.S. median income. Finally, although I'm just a numbers guy, allow me to be romantic a little bit. In the end, slide 12 and 13 talk about my vision for moving Minnesota dairy forward. And the topic there is stronger together. The dairy growth is good for Minnesota. It is good for dairy farmers because through growth, they will be able to have dairy income that satisfies their next generation and brings them back to farm. It's good for dairy processors because it will enable them to keep their plants running at full efficiency and keep their costs low. It's good for local communities. Think about indirect jobs, equipment handlers. Think about grain farmers that have higher basis for their grain and cheaper fertilizer through manure. It's good for dairy consumers because dairy consumers get to consume milk produced locally in the state. It can be good for environment if it's done right. Think about cover crops and the erosion stopped by planting alfalfa hay and grasses. And finally, through taxes, through jobs, through all of this working together, dairy growth is also good for Minnesota economy. I would like to end, I think I have a minute left, I'd like to end with a case study how working together can put Minnesota as a leader, not just regionally, but also nationally. And there are many such examples. Most recent one that I've used to illustrate my point is on the Farm Bill. As you know, it was a big deal for Minnesota agriculture. Our Representative Peterson fought for dairy reforms in Washington. We got the reforms. Our researchers built the tool to explain the new programs to dairy farmers. University and Minnesota Milk and Extension worked together to deliver meetings throughout the state. As a result of this collaborative effort from federal representatives to university to trade associations, I'm proud to say that today Minnesota is the top dairy producing state in terms of adoption of new Farm Bill programs, and our farmers are well protected. Most of them are well protected against any potential decline in milk prices this year. I think that is a case study of what we can do if we work together. I think that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Assistant Professor. So, in your opinion, you think the industry is doing quite well at this point?
Industry has entered 2015 strongly, but we need to work together to make it future-proof and ensure that it stays dynamic in years to come. Excellent. We have a lot of work to do.
Okay. Very good. Any questions for the testifier members? If not, thank you very much for your presentation. Very helpful. Mr. Luneman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Pat Luneman. I'm a dairy farmer from Todd County, Minnesota, and serve as president of the Minnesota Milk Producers. I just want everyone to know that Minnesota Milk has provided some goodies, some white and chocolate milk for not only the committee, but anyone in the room. And there's also some string cheese and other cheese goodies that's over in this cooler over here. Okay. So I just want you to know that. And also you have a handout. It's called Stronger Together that I believe you have in front of you. And you can review that at your leisure, but take a good look at that. I want to talk about, first of all, a study that Midwest Dairy Association, our checkoff association that dairy farmers pay into, commissioned last year, and they had Blimling and Associates do the study. It was a very in-depth study. It was about a 2-inch, 3-inch thick binder of materials. It covered everything as to how Minnesota and the other Midwest states compare to the rest of the states in the United States. It covered everything from business climate and taxes, existing infrastructure, and our resources, just to name a few. And, of course, taxes. Minnesota does not fare very well. However, some of the other leading dairy states are highly taxed as well. When we look at business climate, Minnesota ranks among the top. Looking at infrastructure, we have a good dairy infrastructure in Minnesota, but the thing that really stands out is our resources. We have the land, the water, and the feed and the infrastructure here to create a more vibrant dairy industry. Now, you just looked at Dr. Bozick's presentation, and I want to say that we need to get serious about some of the things that he's shown us. And coming up on Monday, our dairy industry is having a dairy growth summit at the University of Minnesota. And all of the who's who in dairy in Minnesota will be at that event, along with President Kaler from the University of Minnesota, the deans from the various departments, CFANS, Vet Med, and Extension. And Dr. Bozick will be there. He's been instrumental in putting this together, along with Gene Hugeson, our former Ag Commissioner. And Gene is actually taking a real lead on Monday. And we even have John Linkstein from Minnesota Pollution Control coming to have dialogue with us. We're going to have discussion. But we hope it's not just a feel-good meeting, a feel-good day. We need to come out of Monday with an idea and a plan for where we take Minnesota's dairy industry into, where we go into the future. And we hope to come out of Monday with a bucket list of jobs that need to be done to get our dairy and our livestock industry on a higher level. Now, what are the challenges that you can help with? Maren, Dr. Bozick here talked about 3,499 dairy farms being left on December 31st. Many of those dairy farms are run by baby boomers like me. And 10 to 20 years from now, hopefully we'll be having fun somewhere else in January and February. Just come home to visit, you know. We need to think outside the box. How are we going to transfer our farms to the next generation? And I know that that's not just dairy farms. That's all farms in Minnesota and even other small businesses. How do we make that transfer? We need to remove the barriers. And one idea is to create tax incentives for sellers to sell and buyers to buy. And we know that what you can do as a state entity, we're limited, but we need to figure out whatever we can to make these transfers happen. And we also need to remember that not all transfers will be family. I have 5 sons and a daughter, and I'm not sure if any of them are coming home. So we need to think about maybe outside the box again, maybe non-family members, someone coming in to take over our farms. We need to make that a friendly transfer. I have a friend, Bruce Stone, that's here today that's in the middle of that. He's got someone from outside that's coming in onto his farm, and hopefully they can transition that forward. Another area where you can help is regulatory reform. We must improve and accelerate the processes for permitting while still achieving high environmental standards. We don't want to ignore that. That's not our goal here. If a farm meets all standards for a permit, there should be certainty of a permit. Wisconsin, Iowa, and South Dakota are all ahead of us. And there's actually, when you look at maps of dairy development, there's a horseshoe around us that South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin have created. They're growing dairy, and we're staying status quo. We need to do something about that. Now, the elephant in the room today is, of course, the Citizens Board, and their action in a recent hearing that they had sent up another flare that Minnesota continues to be a flyover state in trying to attract dairy farmers from other regions. I'm not sure how you're going to deal with that, but we need to figure out how we can handle our permitting process in a manner that's fair to everyone. We also need to create an equal playing field with our neighbors. I talked about that horseshoe effect around us. We need to look at federal exemption of overtime for agriculture. Our neighbors all do that. Now, whether we do that or not is up to you, but we need to think about how do we compare to the states around us. We ask that you continue and enhance the Livestock Investment Grant Program. It is working. I actually applied for the grant, but I was denied because I didn't score well enough because I wasn't a young farmer. The good news is that the young farmers are getting the money, and that's really where the dollars need to be transferred to, and so I was denied. That's okay. We ask that you support a new independent production ag research fund. We're asking for $15 million per year or $30 million for the biennium. And this will go, as we see it, to an independent entity. And the funds may end up at the University of Minnesota or in some other college setting, or it's up to you how you determine that. But our research dollars in Minnesota, if you go back to the year 2000, we're about $15 million short than we were back in 2000. Now, we've covered a lot of years since then. Let's at least get our research budgets in the state back up to where we were 15 years ago. We need a new dairy research teaching and consumer education facility. What we have planned with the Dairy Authority and working with the University of Minnesota is that be placed in the St. Paul campus. And I want you to visualize this dairy research facility as being not only research, but teaching of our university students and consumer education. It's right next to the state fairgrounds. And then you also need to think about high tech. That's where we see this going. High technology, informatics, think about sustainability, research on the environment and how that all comes together. And Dr. Brian Boer is the one who actually has said that this could be a dairy ecosystem, something that we can put together that will lead our dairy industry into the future. I believe and trust that Dr. Brian Boer is the person to help lead this. We've also had conversations with Dr. Kaler on this. And this summer, I hope that you put this project on your bonding tour and look for us to come back next year with bonding for requests for planning. And my closing quote is that of another dairy farmer. All dairy farmers need all dairy farmers. Each one large or small, conventional or organic, they all fill a role in our consumer demand, our dairy infrastructure, and our rural communities, and of course our state's economy. We must all work together to that end. Let's make sure that we grow together, stronger, just as your handout says. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Luneman. Thank you both for your presentation. Members, did you have any questions for the testifiers? If not, I just want to say, Mr. Luneman, I think that your timing is perfect. You want one? Okay, just a minute.
Is it a question?
Okay. And then, because I know Senator Weber serves with me on Senator Tomasoni's committee, we just had lengthy discussions with the Pollution Control Agency regarding the Citizens Board and a lot on regulatory reform. So we're going to work hard in that area, I believe, this year. And so I think it's great what you guys are doing. Good luck with your summit on Monday. Hopefully you can report some items back to not only myself, but the entire community committee. So thank you for that. Senator Bonoff, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recently met with somebody from the Milk Association who brought the same concern around transferring the farm to not just, you know, it could also be family members, and wanting to have that be done in a way that, you know, would not hurt his family in terms of tax implication. Is there a recommendation, even if it's not family, you talked about that you are asking the legislature to consider how to make this a smooth transition and encourage people to want to come into farming. Do you guys have a recommendation specifically about what we could do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know that we have a specific recommendation. This is a broad picture thing. One thing that I want you to think about is the asset value on many of our farms today, and even our small businesses. We're talking not just tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. We may be talking millions of dollars.
Right.
Okay. And when we try to get a new person or a young person to transfer into our farms, you know, the capital requirements are enormous. So anything that we can do, and I know that sometimes things are limited, but we need to think outside the box. That's why I brought that up. And I don't have anything specific today, but it's a major concern when we look at the age of our farmers as to where we're going to be 10 and 20 years from now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you very much for that. And as you meet and talk amongst yourselves, I think you just know we really would love to hear if you do have outside-the-box ideas, because I find that usually the people in the industry are the most likely to come up with the solutions.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for your presentation. Again, thank you for the treats. And members, you should have an invite. They do have a nice event this evening, and hopefully most of you can try to get down there as well. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have the Department of Agriculture members. We're going to review the change items in their budget. There are a significant number of policy implications in their proposal, so I thought it'd be a good idea to get an overview so we're better prepared when the bill is actually ready. So I believe that Santo is here, Santo Cruz.
Yes, for the record, Santo Cruz.
Welcome. To take your time. Just get settled in.
Thank you for having us today. As I get settled in, as you said, we do not have language yet, still being drafted. I think what we'll do today, in the interest of time, and there are a number of these change items, I'll go through the first two because those are kind of agency-wide, or at least the second one is something that's been on the consciousness of many legislators. And then I'll basically call up in order the division directors to speak to the individual proposals and to take questions. Obviously, we'll have to be brief today given the number and that we're not the last people on the agenda, but I do want to thank you, Chair Sparks, for inviting us today to kind of give this overview. I think it's a good opportunity to start this conversation. There are some substantial things being done. They do have policy implications, as you said, and so I think I'll just kick it off here with the agency-wide, and by that I mean across the agency system. There was a 1.8% increase basically to handle COLAs, the cost of living increases that have been absorbed throughout the agency system over the past 10 years. I've heard numbers that from MMB indicating something to the effect of there's been a 7% cost absorption through COLAs over the past 10 years or something like that, and I can get specific numbers on that, but this is just an effort by the governor to alleviate some of those absorptions over time. The second one, I think, is very relevant to this committee. The governor is recommending doubling the wolf depredation account. As many of you are aware, the delisting of the wolf in a federal case in Washington, D.C. on December 19th of last year was rather unexpected. It injuncted Minnesota from carrying on its own management of wolves. That is currently the status we're in, where only an agent of the government can take a wolf. So what had previously been the case was a farmer could take a wolf that was deprecating on its livestock when there was cause to do so, and there was a wolf season. That has been reverted, and now farmers are no longer in a position to mitigate their own losses. So historically, we have had a depredation account. Given the number of wolves in Minnesota, this is the first year since the beginning of the program where MDA has run out of funds. That has never happened before, but in this current year, this fiscal year, we have several claims. I think it's 30, but we'll have a testifier later who can speak directly to the exact number and the value, that will not be paid because the funds have been exhausted from the wolf depredation account. It is actually the wolf and elk depredation account. The rider allows the funds to be used up in either scenario, but certainly the wolf situation is what drove the change to basically double it from a $200,000 account over the biennium to now a $400,000 account over the biennium. So I would take any questions on that before I start turning it over to Ben Miller and Nikki Kneeser.
Any question, members? If not, thank you for that change. We know that's a real issue, and appreciate that.
And state your name for the record and start off with your change items. Here's what they have.
All right, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dr. Nikki Kneeser. I'm the manager of the Commercial Feed Unit Dairy Inspection Program and Meat and Poultry Inspection Program at the Department of Agriculture. And I'm going to speak to the next two change items. The first one here is the Dairy Program General Fund Increase change item. In that change item, the governor recommends an increase to the Dairy General Fund appropriation of $200,000 per year. The reason for this increase is that the program is projecting a significant funding shortfall over the next 2 years. For a little background, the dairy inspection program is funded by general fund appropriation as well as fees. And over the past few years, that general fund appropriation, or the portion of general fund that the dairy program has been getting, has been smaller, and so we've had to use more of our fees to cover the cost of that program. And as a result, we've essentially used up those savings, and now we're projecting up to about $1 million shortfall over the next 2 years. So that general fund, the first general fund appropriation addresses that. Also of note is that dairy inspection, and we just did hear about the dairy industry from the producers and the industry folks, and dairy inspection is also a very important part of that industry. Inspection frequencies and regulatory mandates are required to be met in order for dairy plants and dairy producers to market their products interstate and internationally. And so if we're not able to meet those, that has a very significant impact on that industry. The next proposal is a similar one, although it asks for a general fund appropriation for laboratory work for the dairy inspection program. Laboratory sampling is an important component of the dairy inspection program. And again, we need to meet a minimum number of laboratory samples to meet those interstate milk shipment requirements. So right now, we're testing around 3,000 samples a year, and 96% of those are only to meet the minimum requirements of that regulation. We have the dairy inspection program itself has been funding that sampling, transferring funds to the lab to pay for that sampling, a significant amount, as you can see in the change item, since 2009, where we increased that funding by almost 300,000, a little under 300,000, in order to pay for that sampling. And as a result, the program has been deficit spending in order to pay for that sampling. So this proposal is intended to make up some of that difference. All right. The next proposal is for additional meat inspection staff. And the recommendation is an increase of $250,000 per year in the general fund as an appropriation to the meat and poultry inspection program. This program is the Minnesota Equal To Meat Inspection Program. Equal To means we do inspections equal to that of USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service. These inspections are required by meat processors in order to wholesale their products. And so this is also has an important impact. Commerce is definitely impacted by the availability of inspectors. Right now we have about 53 plants, between 50 and 55, depending on the season. In the Minnesota Equal To program, we actually have 22 plants in some stage of waiting for inspection. Inspection is required to be done what's termed continuously. Continuous inspection means every animal that is slaughtered is inspected, and processing inspections are done daily. In order to, this program also receives a 50% match from the USDA. So in order to receive that match, we have to meet certain requirements, and one of those is inspection frequency. So we aren't able to take another plant on until we have an inspector to cover that plant. And so we're seeing just a huge demand for the services right now, and so that's what this proposal is intended to address.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just add on while they're getting their bearings. With regard to the meat inspection, this is really an economic driver for outstate Minnesota. We've heard loud and clear from, as you heard Mr. Luneman testify, the livestock investment grant through the Agri Fund has been very successful, and it's something that they support, as well as the value-added business grant. A good example, one I was talking with Mr. Bob LaFave earlier, was the Redheaded Creamery out of Benson that received a value-added business grant. All of these things drive value-added agriculture, more livestock, which is an economic driver, as you heard, to the tune of $7,000 per cow in outstate Minnesota. But then, of course, that means that there needs to be processing, and to be federally compliant, you need to have someone there on slaughter day. So we have done a good job on our mandate to drive the economy of that part of our mission at MDA through the Agri Fund, but now we need to get the other side of that, the corollary, which is making sure that those products get to market.
I'm going to move to the next change item with respect to my area is the feed tonnage inspection fee. So I think you can skip over the corporate farm filing and canning case fee assessment.
Okay. What page, Ms. Nesser?
22.
Okay, thank you.
All right. This proposal is for the commercial feed inspection unit, and it is recommending an increase in the feed tonnage inspection fee of 10 cents per ton, and that current fee is at 16 cents, and it raises it to 26 cents. It's projected to generate about $500,000 per year. The purpose of this proposal is similar to some of the others, is the feed inspection program is projecting a significant deficit in 2018 and 19, so a little farther out. However, it takes quite a bit of time for this statute to sort of, and the impact to hit our revenue streams. And so the first revenue we would see from this change would be in 2017, and so that's why this proposal is coming this year. This proposal is also needed. The commercial feed inspection unit is going to be asked to comply with the FSMA requirements, the Food Safety Modernization Act, on the federal side of things, as well as some program regulatory standards. And so in order to meet those, we need to make sure we maintain adequate staffing.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I would just add that this fee was the last change, I believe, in 1925. And if you adjusted for inflation, we'd be raising it to about $140 rather than just $100.
Okay. All right. The next proposal is the Next, what should be the next one in order, page 24, the feed tonnage fee payer proposal. This is essentially a policy change. This is a proposal that's basically fee neutral to the Department of Agriculture, but it changes how the tonnage inspection fee, the one we just talked about raising, is applied. And the purpose of this is to simplify that that fee and the payment of the fee. Our feed inspection program does audits of fee payers to ensure that the fee payers are paying adequate amounts. And actually, on 72% of the fees that have been, or the fee payers, have submitted the wrong payments. So we have a lot of confusion out there about what fees who needs to pay the fee and when it should be paid. So currently that fee is expected to be paid by the first firm to distribute a feed in Minnesota. So if it's a manufacturer in Minnesota or an outstate, it's the first firm, you know, on the simplest sense, we talk about corn. You know, if they distribute corn in Minnesota, whether it's to a feed mill, a farmer, another distributor, they pay the fee. The change is to make it the last firm that distributes the product in Minnesota, and they need to be distributing that to an unlicensed firm. And by unlicensed, typically those are farmers or maybe a retail store. So it sort of moves it from the first firm in the whole process into the last firm in the whole process. We expect this is done purely to simplify the law. This is makes our law much more consistent with other states' laws. All right, and the next change item is the dairy farm inspection fee increase. That's on page 26. I talked about two dairy inspection program change items already. This is the third, and these are really intended as a package to address the projected funding shortfall that the dairy program is seeing over the next biennium. So this proposal proposes to raise the farm inspection fees for grade A farms from the current level of $50 annually to $150 annually. And that covers two inspections per farm. For grade B farms, this proposal changes, or this proposal would be moving the fee from $25 annually to $75 annually, and that covers one inspection per farm. Generally speaking, well, when we run the numbers on the cost of performing a dairy inspection, this change, so the $150 level for two inspections, so about $75 inspection, is about 60% of the actual cost that it costs the department. So we're not really aiming to cover the whole cost of that inspection, but up to 60%. And that's just the actual inspectors going out there. We're not talking about the overhead support as well on that. So one other point to make is that the fee is expected to bring in $317,000 during the first year, but that those projections decrease over time because we are projecting that the number of farms will decrease over time as well.
Ms. Nesser, are the two inspections, is that enough to be compliant with the law? Would they need any more than the two inspections?
Mr. Chair, yes, two inspections is enough to be compliant. Okay. These are routine inspections. There's a different fee for re-inspections that cover those.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Benjamin Miller, and I manage our food and response program within the Dairy and Food Inspection Division, and I'll take you through the remainder of our division's change items. So if we go back to page 20 in your change item packet there, you'll find that we have a canning case fee assessment proposal. This proposal is to increase the maximum fee that can be charged for a canning case fee assessment for commercial canneries in Minnesota. We inspect those typically during the canning season, so in the spring, summer, and fall months. We'll do a pre-pack inspection and then try to get in and do an inspection for each one of the products that are being packaged there. And those are fairly complex inspections. I don't know if you've ever had an opportunity to be in one of those facilities, but a lot of retorts, high pressure, high temperature, and there's some very specific federal regulation that oversees what needs to be done for those facilities. So they're technical inspections. That canning case fee assessment helps offset some of the inspection costs for that. It was last increased in 2001 to a maximum of $6,000 per fee payer. The proposal is to increase that to $12,000 now. Previous to 2001, in 1991, it was $3,000. So it's been a number of years since that's gone up and would generate roughly about $70,000 more in revenue to pay for inspection time and staff to do that work. The next proposal, I will take you to page 28 in your change item packet. This is the delegated food inspection program change item. The intent of this is to mirror what the Department of Health does in terms of oversight of delegation agreements that it has with local health boards. So Department of Agriculture, similar to the Department of Health, delegates a certain amount of its retail food inspection authority to local entities, and right now that's cities and counties in Minnesota. We have 7 delegation agreements, primarily in the metro area. This would be provide a mechanism to fund the oversight and evaluation of those programs and provide technical expertise to the delegated agency staff. Right now we don't have any specific line item funding source for that, and when this was passed, I think back in 1999 or 2000, no additional funding was put in place for the oversight of this program, but we certainly put a lot of effort into trying to support those agencies, and our staff probably receive several calls a day from any of those delegated agencies with questions, technical questions on specific inspection activities, things like that. So this would create a fee that is charged to licensee that would fund one FTE to provide regular outreach, oversight, and help conduct evaluation assessments of the performance of those programs, because they are delegated and we have to ensure that they meet standard of inspection. The next change item be found on page 31, and that would be the retail food handler plan review fee. This is a fee increase on the retail plan review fee category. You can see there at the bottom what those fee change would look like. This is essentially to ensure that we can conduct and review facility plans. So when a new business opens or the major remodeling happens in something like a grocery store or a convenience store, any kind of retail food facility that the department inspects, they're required to submit construction plans. And so the review of those plans is contingent on them engaging in whatever activity they'd like to do. So if that's opening or opening that new part of the store, opening a new business. So we want to make sure that we can turn that around as quickly as possible. Right now there's a requirement in the food code that we process those plans within 30 days of receipt. And given the current level of revenue, we bring in around between $60,000 and $70,000 a year to fund that. This would generate an additional $100,000. We commit.
Right. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mr. Cruz.
I want to jump in here real quick just to say, bring some good news. Sometimes, we're never going to be here to brag about being backlogged. That's not something that the department really brags about, in the sense that we have our statutory duties and our charges of ensure the safety of the food supply and grow the egg economy. However, in this regard, this is good news that we're not keeping up with these plans, in the sense that this means the economy is growing, people are expanding their food businesses, we're getting more submissions, and keeping up with a growing economy is a good problem to have. And I won't brag about being backlogged in any other area, but certainly in this one I will.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Miller?
Mr. Chair, and to echo Mr. Cruz's comments, there's actually an article in the MinnPost, if you had a chance to read that, but about how there's an expanding retail grocery food sector, you know, all the building that's going on in that. And so all of that needs to go through the department for approval. So we need to make sure that we are adequately staffed so we can turn those reviews around in a timely fashion.
Can we talk about how much that fee is increasing?
In some instances, you'll see on the low end, so it's currently based off square footage. You see it's going from $200 to $600, $275 to $825, $425 to $1,275, which is a significant increase. That matches more closely, as I mentioned, the delegated agencies that we delegated authority to. Some charge plan review fees higher than what's being proposed here. So it's essentially in line with what other agencies are charging for that work. It's just been a long time since we've actually increased those fees.
Thank you, Dr. Miller.
I'm actually going to skip one and come back just for the order here. If we go to page 38, Retail Food Safety Unified Regulation change item. This is actually a shared change item with the Minnesota Department of Health. Over the past several years, the Health Department and the Department of Agriculture have made an effort to more closely align the work that we do around retail food inspection. We both have responsibility for that. We do essentially grocery stores, convenience stores, things like that. They do restaurants. We use the same food code for that, for those inspections. So we want to make sure that we're more uniform in the way that we're licensing and inspecting essentially what are the same businesses. So we might have a grocery store that has a restaurant in it, and they might have a restaurant that has a grocery component to it. One of us will license them based on the predominance of that activity. But we want to make sure that the regulatory experience between those two agencies is as close as it can be. This proposal is really driven at that. It looks at the way that we license retail food facilities. In the past, we've done that based on their gross annual sales, so how much food did they sell. And the health department has done it on the number of seats within a restaurant. This takes and looks at what's the amount of effort that's required to actually inspect a facility. So it takes and looks at a risk-based or complexity-based model of licensing. So if there's a more complex activity, if there's a lot of food handling going on in a facility, they're serving ready-to-eat food, the complexity of the activity is greater, and so therefore the amount of time required to conduct that inspection is longer. So you'll see a change in the proposed way that we're actually licensing those facilities. This proposal also would dedicate the fees collected from those licenses so that the department can create a dedicated account to fund that inspection work, and it would increase the total amount of revenue to deal with a significant backlog in inspections. We are required to inspect high-risk facilities once a year, medium-risk once every 18 months, and low-risk once every 24 months. So right now we don't have staff adequate spread out throughout the state of Minnesota to do that. We've got about 27 inspection FTEs to cover over 10,000 food facilities in the state. So, and that includes retail. That's where I will back up several pages to go to the wholesale manufacturer food license proposal on page 34. This is essentially meant to mirror that change in retail food license structure. So going away from a gross annual sales model to more of a risk and complexity-based model. And the importance of that, Dr. Neisser mentioned, Food Safety Modernization Act. That was an act that Congress passed back in 2011. And the rules that are promulgated from that act are actually going to come into effect starting in August of 2015. And it really represents some of the most significant changes in food law that we've seen in 60 or 70 years in this country. So it moves from what I would call cleanliness, sanitation, floors, wall, ceiling approach to food inspection at the manufactured level, and this includes FDA's authority, to a risk-based preventative inspection approach, so that food manufacturers take a very hard look at what are the risks in their process and write plans to address that. That will change the way that we inspect as well, and it will require us to spend more time in those facilities. So this proposal mirrors the changes to a risk and complexity-based licensing model with the goal of attempting to adequately staff for the rollout of the Food Safety Modernization Act, and we'll have to start inspecting against that later this year. This, too, would dedicate the fees collected for that those activities. And I believe that is all. Those are all the change items that we have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Miller and Dr. Neisser, both of you. That's the change items, Mr. Cruz?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We would probably move on now to the bulk anhydrous ammonia fertilizer change item on page 42.
Okay.
So if we could have our pesticide and fertilizer management division come on up. I believe they have three areas to discuss. I don't think we'll get to the clean water funding here today.
Okay.
Because it is very involved, but certainly we will go through at least the two proposals regarding pesticide and fertilizer management division.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Greg Bozicki. I'm the Division Director of Pesticide and Fertilizer Management. I will take you through the change item on page 42, the bulk and anhydrous ammonia fertilizer, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Joe Spitzmuller to deal with a couple other that are in our division. What we're proposing is a 9 cent per ton increase on the fertilizer fee. This will result in a net revenue increase of about $250,000. This amounts to about a penny per row crop acre in the state. We are targeting these increased revenues on two critical areas. I will talk about them one after another. The first is the bulk fertilizer storage area. Mr. Chair and members, we have about 415 tanks in this state that are 20 to 30,000 gallons, and about 30 sites with about 90 tanks that have net storage over 50,000 gallons. Many of these tanks were built and with dikes around 1990 in the 1990s when we passed our rules. Since that time, there's been consolidation, so there's been some movement. We permit all of these buildings and these tanks, but we haven't had the resources to go out and do very complete and detailed inspections of these. We anticipate that there is going to be in the coming years about an increase of 18% in storage. So this is a growing area, more consolidation, more tanks. Some of these tanks since the 1990s are outliving their usefulness. We respond to about 2 to 6 releases of these kinds of tanks per year. So these additional resources will be used to aid in the permitting, quicker turnaround. Although we have good turnaround right now, we do that because we really work with the industry on the front end. But we also want to be doing additional inspections and getting out there and looking at these tanks and making sure that they are in good shape, and when they need to be replaced, they are replaced. So we're looking at field inspection, one full-time equivalent, to increase our field inspection capacity, and then also increase our office permit review. And Mr. Chair, one final word. Result on this with a dike that does not contain the spill can be a very catastrophic event, and it results in a very costly cleanup that affects the whole industry and certainly the responsible party. So we see this as certainly as regulatory, but it's also service oriented. The second component of this is anhydrous ammonia. Mr. Chair and members, we have about 287 permitted anhydrous ammonia facilities in this tank. Anhydrous ammonia is a gas that is stored under pressure, and if it is released, it is hydrolyphic, which means it loves water, which means that basically if you inhale it, it loves your lungs and it burns you. It's a very dangerous fertilizer to be used. It has to be handled very appropriately. About 70 to 80% of these anhydrous ammonia facilities are located in or near small towns in Minnesota. In 2010, we had two very high visibility releases. We have a number of them that occur. Some are small, some are large. But in 2010, we had two high visibility releases, one that resulted in a significant evacuation of a school in not Rosemont, but just south of the cities. I apologize, Mr. Chair. And another one that resulted in an evacuation of about 1,000 people in Morris, Minnesota. Fortunately, nobody was injured at those, but we do every year, or frequently, I should say, have injuries and deaths by applicators and handlers. In 2012, in response to some of this, we asked for an increase in fees. We were provided with a $268,000 one-time appropriation from the general fund to increase our inspection capacity. We used those dollars over the recent years to increase our inspection rotation from once every 6.8 years to once every 3 years. We would like to maintain that inspection rotation. We would also like to maintain or improve our ability to provide compliance assistance. A small percentage of tanks, of nurse tanks, are actually owned by farmers, about 5 to 10%. So while we'd focus on facilities, this will also be in a safety outreach to farmers. Mr. Chair, that is the bulk and anhydrous ammonia fertilizer change. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much. You did a nice job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Joe Spitzmuller. I'm a manager at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. I'm going to talk about two change items today located on, you'll locate them on pages 48 and 49. First one is entitled Structural Pest Control Applicators, Structural Pest Control. Just for a little bit of background, structural pest control refers to those people who I used to know as exterminators. The industry standard is pest management professionals, but these are the folks that come into your home and address the unfortunate situations where you might have some creepy, unwanted creepy crawlers in your home. These are highly trained professionals, well-educated, and work in very sensitive situations, work inside homes, hospitals, and other very sensitive sites. They are, as I say, industry standards are very high, and regulation is as well. This proposal, the current regulation addresses both the use of pesticide and the use of non-pesticidal means to control pests. What this regulation does is to refocus the regulation on the use of pesticides and reduce the regulation of non-pesticidal means. So, for example, in the current regulation, a person who was going to try to evict a bat from your home and would use a one-way valve or netting to do that, or simple carpentry work, in fact, would need to be licensed as a structural pest control applicator to do this under the current regulation. There's a large industry of people who control nuisance wildlife in homes who are unable to get this license because of the experiential requirements. And so the intent of this regulation is really to focus it on the use of pesticides and eliminate or reduce the emphasis on non-pesticidal means. The dollars, the revenue, there will be some shifts in licenses. People will buy, people will let go. So that's where the revenue comes from. The expenses will be, there'll be extensive outreach in making sure the industry understands the intent of this regulation. Item number two deals with restricted use pesticides. These are pesticides that are classified, that's a classification assigned by the Environmental Protection Agency to pesticides who have some sort of a environmental or public health issue associated with them. And the intent is to ensure that they're only used by licensed pesticide applicators. The current regulation for dealers to sell pesticide, restricted use pesticides, says that they can only sell to licensed or certified applicators. So those would be commercial applicators, those might be farmers or other persons who would use restricted use pesticide in their activity. The current regulation on the applicator side does not use the term purchase. It only uses the term use. So this regulation would include the term purchase and use in the regulations for applicators. In effect, it would not change the way we interpret this regulation. It would simply clarify the understanding that applicators need to be certified or licensed to purchase and use restricted-use pesticide. We do have some rules in place that would allow for in the case of a farmer who needs to is in the middle of a farming operation, needs to send someone to town to make a purchase on their behalf. And in our rules, we interpret as long as that person can bring the appropriate documentation, a transaction can occur. And that wouldn't change the way we would interpret that at all. It simply clarifies the language that an applicator must be licensed to purchase restricted-use pesticides.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm with the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. And I'm here to talk about the change item, which is titled Monitoring for Pesticides in Surface Water and Groundwater, but the name is wrong. That's actually all of our clean water legacy funding initiatives roll into one. And in the interest of time, I'll go through them pretty fast. We have this is on page 50 to 52. We have nine different programs that are funded under this initiative. Eight of these are ongoing. They're not new. In fact, in two of those, we have a decrease in our requested funding. Two, there's an increase. And then we have one new initiative. So going through the initiatives quickly, our first initiative is called Monitoring for Pesticides, Surface Water, and Groundwater. We get funding for our laboratory to run some pretty advanced analytical gear. And basically, the equipment has been purchased. This is funding that goes directly to the lab to run the samples. And that's $700,000 for the biennium, and that is not a change. That's been ongoing. The second one is nitrate in groundwater. The request is for $5.3 million. That's a slight increase from our current request, and that is for funding for the department to address nitrates in groundwater, which is a very difficult and challenging issue. Our agency is the lead agency in the state of Minnesota to address nitrates in groundwater, and this is a major funding source for us to do so. Third is academic research and evaluation. That's $2.1 million. That is not an increase. That's the same funding that we've already had. And what we do is we have all of this money, except for a very small amount, is passed through to academic researchers. We have an advisory team that helps us select projects, and this is funding that's used for addressing some of the research that's needed to evaluate practices and come up with tools to determine what ag's contribution is. And so, again, most of this funding is for pass-throughs. It's not spent by the department. Number four is the Ag Best Management Practice Loan Program. We're requesting $150,000. This is down from our previous request to $400,000. This is a long-standing program that provides very low-cost loans to implement best management practices. This is just for administrative costs, and we do need the money to actually run the administrative costs. And we prorate our costs to just those activities that are clean water funded, and anything that's not expended goes into the corpus of the fund. Number five is vegetative cover and soil health. This is actually a new initiative. It's our only new initiative. And we're requesting $350,000 to fund a marketer to evaluate market opportunities. And these are existing opportunities. There's a lot of research on vegetative cover. Most of that's academic research or some demonstration research. This is a very different project. Our goal here is to evaluate existing markets for hay and other crops and see whether or not we can increase vegetative cover in an economically viable way. Number six is technical assistance, and this is technical assistance for impaired waters. This is not an increase. This is the same amount that we requested previously, $3 million. And this is kind of an extension of the research. This is funding that we use to provide technical support to the impaired waters process. So research that's developed by the University of Minnesota or others, we want to make sure that that information isn't lost, and we provide demonstration projects and a presence to make sure that that information gets into the hands of the Pollution Control Agency and other groups who are doing the impaired waters work. Number seven is a research inventory database. This is a decrease. We had asked for $250,000. This is $100,000. The previous request was to develop a database so that research information, which is developed by multiple parties, is easily accessible. And I know databases are very difficult to develop. Well, we've done it. We have it. It's operational. And now this is funding just to make sure that we continue to populate the database and make the information available to others. Number 8 is irrigation water quality protection. This funds a irrigation specialist at the University of Minnesota Extension. This was developed as an outcome from the Minnesota Irrigators Association, who asked that we provide this money. And this is a person at the U who is an irrigation specialist who develops BMPs and provides education on them. And then the last one is the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. The request is $5 million. Our previous request was $3 million. This is for an increase to go statewide. Currently, we have 4 pilot projects in different parts of the state. The pilot projects have been very successful, and now we're ready to go statewide. So I went through those really quick, but that's a quick overview of our clean water funding requests.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stoddard. And actually, Mr. Cruz, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just on that last item, as some of you may be aware, Minnesota is recognized nationally for its program, the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program, and through a competitive process with USDA was one of very few throughout the nation programs awarded funding to support state ramping up of the pilot project to statewide. This $5 million will trigger a $9 million contribution from USDA to go towards this effort.
Very good. And I just want to thank you, Mr. Cruz, and actually to all your members from the Department of Ag. That was very helpful, I think, not only for myself but for committee members. So thanks for pulling together on a short notice, and I'm sure we'll be back to discuss these in more detail at a later date. But I appreciate your job.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this a good time for questions?
Sure. Go ahead.
Just I'm trying to read the biennial budget change items. And so when I look like on page 50, does that mean that there's an additional 25.7 FTEs in 16 and 17? What does that mean exactly?
Mr. Chair, no, that's the total number of FTEs that are funded. And I don't have the exact previous number with me, but it's not a significant change. I think it's almost the same as what were previously funded.
So,
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I'd like to know, as the budget goes forward, how many new full-time employees are in the budget? Either you don't necessarily, for my purposes, have to break it out program by program, but you very well might. But I'd just like to know how many new FTEs are there in this budget category?
Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair, and committee, I will get that emailed to you today. We have that information, and I just need to talk to our CFO, break it. I can either have it broken out, as you've suggested, or just the total number of people who didn't work there last biennium who we're proposing will be working at MDA in the next biennium, and I think that's what you're looking for, and I can get that to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
And Nelson.
If you already have it broken out, fine. That would be helpful, and you can add it all up at the bottom. That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Thanks a lot for the presentation.
Absolutely. We do have one final issue to talk about.
All right.
And that is our change item on our seed work. This is through the Plant Protection Division. If we have time, we can cover it now. If not, I leave it up to the chair. We would see the rest of the time to whatever the committee would like to hear. But
can we briefly just so we still have time to get the Senator Schmidt's bill?
You bet.
Okay.
For the record, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Chuck Dreich. I'm the Assistant Director in the Plant Protection Division, and I'm here just to give you a quick highlight of the seed permit restructuring, which basically is a revision to the fee structure to better reflect the actual revenue and costs associated with each segment of the industry. So we are proposing to change this is for a fully dedicated program which has not had a fee adjustment since 2003. And briefly, we're looking at changing how we associate costs and charge or obtain revenue for 3 major agricultural seeds. The change will be to a unit basis instead of a current hundredweight, which closely matches the standard of units sold to farmers, and establish a reporting method for native or conservation and reclamation seed, which is sold in contractor basis. This allows a very clear definition of what is expected to be paid by all the producers, because it again does align with the way they buy their seeds. There is a change in revenue to this effect of about $340,000 in fiscal year 2016, the same in 2017 for a total over the biennium of $680,000. There's a budgetary impact of the agricultural fund expense increase for the same time frame of around $401,000. So we are building some bit of a reserve here, if you will, to help through any troubled times. If you have any questions, that's as brief as I can make it.
No, that was fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Didn't mean to cut you off.
It's all right.
All right.
Again, thank you, Chair, for allowing us to go through this. I believe that we'll hear more questions as the language gets developed and we move throughout, but this is a good trial run for us to kind of talk about these issues and kind of discuss enterprise-wide what we're looking at and the challenges we're facing.
Excellent. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Mr. Cruz, and to all your testifiers. Excellent job. Last but not least, we're going to have Senator Schmidt, Senate File 152, dealing with agritourism. I do have a list of testifiers, and we'll try to keep it brief. We can go over a little bit, but it'd be nice if we could take some action on this bill yet today. Senator Schmidt, Mr. Vice Chair.
All right, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to see you from this perspective. I'll promise to try to tame the microphone so it doesn't get jumpy down here. In any event, today we have Senate File 152 in front of us. This is a bill known as the Agritourism Bill. And it seeks to address a growing problem in much of rural Minnesota that is due to a welcome trend, and that's a renewed and growing interest in folks visiting our farms. Whether you get out to pick apples or berries, maybe taste wine, we have a lot of growing wineries throughout the state, or other recreational or educational opportunities taking place on the farm, a lot of our farm owners are assuming more and more liability because of these frequent visits. I don't know about you, Mr. Chair, or other members of the committee, but I think a couple of my favorite events taking place down in my district are the annual harvest lunch or a breakfast on the farm. And I know a lot of folks get out and visit the farms in those capacities and others. And so what we're trying to do here in Senate File 152, in Subdivision 1, we have a recognition of several definitions. I would draw your attention to line 1.20, with the inherent risks of agritourism activity. That's going to be much of what our discussion revolves around today. And then also in Subdivision 2, we have provisions related to certain limitations placed on liabilities for the farmers and landowners. We'll be able to get into this in more detail, and I'd certainly, in the interest of time, probably hold off on that discussion for questions later on. Before we do anything, though, perhaps we could move on the A1 amendments, just a couple of technical changes that I'd propose to adopt into the bill sooner rather than later.
Certainly. A member should have the A1 amendment. It's the author's amendment that would get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor of the Schmidt A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Schmidt, to your bill.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just provided a brief overview of what we're trying to do, the challenge that many of our farmers are facing out there with increased liability and insurance premiums. If there are any questions from the committee at this point, I'd be happy to stand for them. Otherwise, again, in the interest of time, we do have some testifiers that would like to speak to the bill.
Sure. Let's bring them up in whatever order you would prefer, Senator Schmidt.
Okay. Maybe we can just work off of your list. So Mr. Okay. Peterson from the Farmers Union, Mr. Busselman from the Farm Bureau.
Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. We strongly support Senate File 152. Appreciate Senator Schmidt working on this bill. We've worked on this bill for many years. We've had different authors in the House. Senator Schmidt, this is second time carrying the bill. We've had members come to us on this bill over the years. I think of different people have come to us that have orchards. I think in southeast Minnesota and in Senator Schmidt's district, I have one in Senator Rood's district, that have had different things happen to them on their farm, whether it's somebody who was out at their farm got poked by an apple fall on their head, and they, you know, come back for different pieces. We have CSAs are another big piece where you have the community supported agriculture. We have people that go out to their farms and they have a day at their farm where they have their customers come out and see. They actually have a deal where they have a weeding day at their farm, so their customers that buy vegetables from them, I always think this is interesting, and they have their customers come out and we help them weed for a day. And so things like this, so I've had people contact me and say, yeah, I've kind of looked at other states, and our insurance companies have said we should look at this agritourism piece. 22 other states, I believe, have passed this legislation. Wisconsin just passed this bill last year, and Governor Walker signed it into law. We also, being Dairy Day at the Capitol, I've also had dairy farm, very large dairy farmer, in fact, called me and was interested in this bill. He put in a viewing room in his farm, and he has a carousel and robotic milkers, and wanted to educate people on that and have people out to his farm. And he called and asked about this because he had been told about this bill in other states, and in what he was reading, he was very interested in this. So that's why where our interest comes is trying to provide some kind of help to those people. We believe the sign also that as part of the bill is helpful in just reminding people that are out at a farm. We've had this type of legislation in Minnesota for a while for horse and livestock type events, where I know I exhibit horses, I see it when I go to activities, and I see the sign. I know it's been helpful over the years. It's not a get out of the jail free card. You still got to have liability insurance. You're still going to be subject to lawsuits, but we are hopeful that the passage of this law will help our farmers who are, as Senator Schmidt said, very interested in more people wanting to get to know how their food is made and produced. And Farmers Union, we think that's a good thing, and we want to encourage that. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Busselman?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Busselman. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. We support the protections that are provided by this bill for activities related to improved interactions with farms. Minnesota Farm Bureau's county farm bureaus are conducting a number of educational activities on an ongoing basis to help provide a better understanding of where our food comes from. Ag in the Classroom tours, community breakfasts on the farm, and similar events help to reconnect consumers with agricultural activities and practices. The protections offered here in this bill recognize and alert those coming on farms of the inherent risk potentially available because they are on a farm. Having said that, sub 2 spells out the limits of what those liability protections are. We thank you for the number of legislators in both bodies who have given their support for signing on to the bill and the concept, and we look forward to working with this committee for passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation, both of you. Do you have a couple more testifiers, Senator Schmidt?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair. We have Brett Olson and Sharon Johnson, I believe, are both here today.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Whichever one of you wants to go first, just state your name. And
I'll start because she has a better story and I don't want to follow it. Thank you, Chair and committee. And thank you, Senator, my senator, actually. My name is Brett Olson, and I work for a nonprofit called Renewing the Countryside, and we have an office in Minneapolis and down in Zumbro Falls. And the interest that we have in this is that Renewing the Countryside has been working on rural tourism and agritourism subjects, issues, workshops, things like that for better part of 6-7 years. And a couple years ago, we did a series of workshops across the state, had 50-plus family farms come take the workshops, work on business plans, figure out what they wanted to do. Pretty excited when they went home. We did our follow-up survey because USDA would love to see a survey result, and we did that. And found that very few of them had followed through, and one of the major things that came back was their township fire and wind or their whatever insurance agency said, yeah, we understand employees, you know, risk, things like that, but we don't do guests on farms. And they were saying that the liability was an issue for them. And so this seemed like, seeing as there was plenty of other states adopting these, and they have been ever since, that it would be a great idea for the state of Minnesota. I know we brought up a couple of instances, CSA Farms weeding. You'd like that, right? And pancake breakfast, raise your hand if you've been to one, because you've been to 1,000 of them. A lot of times these farmers go to bed with their fingers crossed. They tape them up. They just, their fire and wind or their insurance agent just doesn't want to hear about it. That's too big of a risk for a farmer. This doesn't mean they won't carry insurance. They're going to carry insurance. They have responsibilities like that. And they will follow the needed licenses and items along those lines, but it will help them rest a little easier. On top of that, we're working this year with MDA and MDH on an on-farm food service manual that will help farmers realize what those licensing and insurance needs are going to be. That'll be coming out probably a couple months. But for those on-farm food services, pizza farms, things like that, Wisconsin has quite a few pizza farms. And causation, correlation, I know that's not all, science, whatever. But it's the reason that it is growing over there is that farmers feel more at ease at having people come on their farm. So I encourage you to support this set of file, 152. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Thank you for your testimony. Mrs. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Sharon Johnson, and with my husband, Bruce, back here, we own Minnesota Fresh, LLC, and we operate a farm known as Minnesota Fresh Farm in East Bethel, Minnesota. We're located on Highway 65 in the northern part of Anoka County, and our farm has been in Bruce's family for over 80 years. Bruce is a third-generation farmer, and our son, Luke, who farms with us, is a fourth-generation farmer. I'd like to make you aware of Minnesota's farmers and ranchers' need for protection for liability for common agritourism activities. The risk of injury for visitors to our farm is small, but it's real. This bill covers guests to the farm, whether they're paying guests or not paying guests. While most of our revenue now comes from weekly produce boxes that we sell to customers who pick them up on the farm or at the farmer's market, we also have visitors to the farm for U-pick strawberries and raspberries. We also host an occasional wedding and photo shoots. We plan to add fall activities such as pumpkin picking and a small corn maze. And Bruce and I and the insurance company are discussing pumpkin chunking, but that's it's quite a risky activity, so we're still discussing that one. Additionally, we have many non-paying guests on the farm. For instance, students from the Academy of Sciences and Agriculture from Vadnais Heights come out to the farm one day in the spring and one day in the fall, and they help us around the farm to get a taste of farm life. We also host international visitors through the Minnesota International Center and the U.S. State Department's International Visitor Leadership Program. And next week, we'll have four visitors from Japan coming to tour the farm to see what family farm life is like in Minnesota. We've had guests from approximately 15 different countries on the farm in the last 2 years. These activities, whether they're from people from Minnesota, neighboring states, or other countries, help to provide education about the importance of agriculture in Minnesota, and it also provides much-needed recreation for people who may not have the privilege of living in a rural area. Agritourism helps Minnesota tourism in general for the state of Minnesota. The agritourism bill requires farms and ranches to post a sign that notifies visitors of the inherent dangers or conditions that are integral of agritourism activity. These dangers include natural hazards, whether you're tripping on ground, behavior of wild or domestic animals, and ordinary dangers of structures and equipment used in farming and ranching operations. What's most difficult for an agritourism operator such as us to control is the risk of a guest to act in a negligent manner that contributes to their own or someone else's injury. That injury can occur as a result from failing to follow our instructions or just even failing to exercise reasonable care while engaging in the agritourism activity. Paying and non-paying guests are mentioned in the bill. And the bill does limit the liability we incur by having visitors, but it doesn't exempt us from responsibility for our own recklessness. About half the states in the nation have a similar farm bill or a similar agritourism bill. Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota are just a few. This bill is important to our farm because every time we open our farm to visitors, there is a risk that they may stumble on uneven ground, be stung by a bee, or receive a small wound while picking raspberries or other crops. These might seem like small issues, but they can easily turn into a lawsuit that would cost tens of thousands of dollars or more. We do have insurance, and that is the most expensive cost on our farm to us. It's the expense of insurance right now is higher even than seed and fuel. A claim against our policy would raise those rates even more. This bill would also reduce the likelihood of frivolous lawsuits, saving us and our insurance company time and money. Minnesota's farmers and ranchers operate with very tight margins to provide food and other agricultural products for the people of Minnesota. Agritourism activities are becoming popular, a popular way for farmers to add revenue to their farms and to keep the farms in their family. At the same time, Minnesotans are becoming much more interested in the origin of their food, and they're interested in taking their children out to the farms to see where food comes from. When visitors come to our farm, they appreciate the ability to taste a freshly picked strawberry, to learn about Minnesota's farms, or to sit in the sunshine as someone pledges their life in marriage. Passing SB 152, the agritourism bill, will reduce the risks that we are already shouldering and will make it more attractive for new agritourism operators in the state of Minnesota to share in the fruits of the land. I ask for your support of this bill, and thank you again for this time.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Johnson, and to your husband, Bruce, for making the trip and your testimony. With that, I think that's the end of your testifiers, right?
Yeah, that's Senator right, Schmidt? That's right, Senator Sparks.
I believe Mr. Carlson would like to say a few words, and then hopefully we can take some action.
Sure. And just to sum up for members, we had some great testimony here that hopefully brought to life the bill here. And just to reiterate, in Subdivision 1, we define what agritourism professional is. It's a person who is engaged in providing one or more agritourism activities. And in Subdivision 2, we provide that agritourism professional is not liable for the injury, damage, or death of a participant engaged in the agritourism activity unless the agritourism professional commits an act or omission that constitutes gross negligence or willful or wanted disregard for the participant's safety, has knowledge or reasonably should have known of a dangerous condition, and does not make the danger known to the participant, or finally, it intentionally injures the participant. So we have spelled some of those protections out in this bill.
Right. Thank you. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And our association represents individuals, businesses, and others that are injured through the acts or fault of other parties, whether it's a franchisee that is defrauded or one of your constituents that's injured by a drunk driver. And let me say at the onset that on behalf of our organization and myself personally, we are promoters of tourism, and particularly me. And Ms. Johnson, thank you for what you do. It is awesome. I've been to these events. They're great things. Tourism, as you know, if we do a little commercial center road, tourism employs about 250,000 people in the state of Minnesota. It's got $13 billion of gross sales. It generates over $840 million of sales tax, which is 17% of all sales tax collected in the state. It's a very important part of our economy and our heritage in Minnesota. Now, having said that, I also think, though, that we have an obligation both as an organization and as legislators to look at the impacts and consequences, intended or unintended consequences from legislation, however well-intended it is. And our concern with the language of this bill, and I've had a chance to express this to Senator Schmidt, is that it is overly broad and provides very expansive immunity that Minnesota has not in its 150-year-plus history provided to any business entity. I don't think it's the intent of the author to provide that expanse of liability protection. And, you know, some of these issues, I agree, are maybe best debated in the Judiciary Committee, where I generally toil. This is one of my rare excursions into the Agriculture Committee. But I found over the years that when you don't at least tell people that there are concerns about the bill and how it's worded, that when there's a floor amendment or something else, you go, gee, you never told me there was a problem. So that's why I want to at least point a couple things out to the committee. First, I want you to know that Minnesota has long recognized the assumption of risk. Many of the things that they're talking about, Minnesota already recognizes that we're responsible for our own actions, and we think that's right and correct. But we can't assume all risks. And the law doesn't make us assume all risks. We can't assume the bad conduct of others. Children, in particular, don't have the opportunity or the ability to comprehend some of the risks that are present. And we have a higher level of care for children when they're at our establishments. You know, we believe, and the law in Minnesota is that when you're invited to someone's property, you have a reasonable expectation that it will be safe, that the food will be prepared properly, that the alcohol is served correctly, and that they'll use their care to make sure that injuries don't occur. This legislation, we believe, kind of eliminates, or at a minimum lowers, I would say eliminates, those requirements by moving the standard to a gross negligence standard, which is not used in civil cases. That is probably our biggest concern about the bill. And when you talk about the 22 other states that have adopted similar legislation, and I've read them all, many of them are not written like this. In fact, I can't find one that's quite written like this, and this is something that we can work through in the Judiciary Committee, but in 150 years, Minnesota has not granted governmental sanctioned immunity for negligent conduct to any business in the state of Minnesota, and this is a departure from that, and we'd like to get closer to that as the bill moves through the process. And Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions. I know you don't want a line by line analysis of the bill, and I'm not ready to do that damage to you. But we appreciate you thoughtfully thinking about this, because there, you know, when it's your child, when it's your neighbor's child, and when it's a family member who is injured, not through their own action, but through the action of a business owner or operator, you're going to want to protect their constitutional right to have a remedy, and that's what we're trying to do. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer questions.
Mr. Carlson, thank you for coming to the Ag Committee and voicing your concern. Any questions for Mr. Carlson members? Sarah Nelson.
I have a question, and Mr. Carlson might be the person to answer it, or it might be the bill's author. But in understanding Senate File 152 here, and actually the second part of the bill on the limited liability, I understand your position, Mr. Carlson, which is you want to make sure that people always have the legal options open to them. And I also understand the testifiers' reason that, you know, we might like to keep things out of legal lawsuits and such. So I understand that. It's my phone. I don't know whose phone that is. Okay. I think it's my mic. All right. So my question is this.
Senator Root, can you turn your microphone away from?
And Mr. Chair, I'll try again. I'm going to skip the mic.
I can hear you.
So my question is,
What? Okay. Senator Weber says I'm an electric personality.